Chapter 37. The executive jet lifted off at daybreak the next morning, but instead of heading towards London's Heathrow Airport, it set a direct course for Paris. Before the plane was in the air, Austin had talked Mayhew into changing his flight plan. He said he didn't have time to go into details, but that it was a matter of life and death. Mayhew asked only one question. Does this have anything to do with the matter we discussed last night? It could have everything to do with it. Then I should expect that you will keep me up to date as to the progress of your investigations. I'll give you the same report I send to my superiors at Numa. Mayhew smiled and they shook hands on the deal. By late morning, they were at Charles de Gaulle Airport. The Trouts split off and headed to Chateau country, and Austin and Zavala hopped aboard a charter flight to the quaint alpine village nearest the glacier. Zavala had called his friend Denise in the French Parliament. After extracting a promise from Zavala to see her again, she arranged to have a fast 18-foot powerboat waiting for them at the village. They had traveled up the twisting river all afternoon and arrived at Lac de Dormieux at dusk. Not wanting to announce their arrival, they kept their speed low as they crossed the misty, mirror-still lake waters and wove their way around the miniature icebergs that spotted the surface. The four-stroke outboard motor was whisper quiet, but to Austin's ears, it was like someone shouting in a cathedral. Austin steered the boat toward a single-engine float plane that was anchored a few feet off the beach. The boat pulled alongside the plane, and Austin climbed onto a float to peer inside the cockpit. The plane was a de Havilland Otter with space for 9 passengers. 3 seats were stacked with scuba gear, confirming Lysara's observation that the plane was being used as a dive platform. Austin got back in the boat and surveyed the beach. Nothing moved in the gray light. He ran the boat further along the shore, pulled it behind a rock outcropping, and then he and Zavala made the long hike up to the power plant. They traveled lightly, carrying water, power bars, handguns, and extra ammunition. Even so, it was dark when they reached the plant. The door to the portal building was unlocked. The interior of the building was hushed except for the hum of the turbine. Austin slowly pivoted on his heel as he stood in the power plant lobby, his ears tuned to the beehive humming that issued from the bowels of the mountain. His coral blue eyes narrowed. "Something's wrong," he said to Zavala. "The turbine is working." "This is a power plant," Zavala said. "Isn't the generator supposed to be working?" "Yes, under normal circumstances. But Lysara told me on the phone that he would try to shut down the turbine. The power loss would start bells clanging at the main office, and they'd have to send someone in to investigate." "Maybe Lysara changed his mind," Zavala said. Austin shook his head almost imperceptibly. "I hope it wasn't changed for him." After exploring the office and living quarters, Austin and Zavala left the lobby and made their way to the control room. Austin paused outside the door. All was quiet, but Austin's sixth sense told him that there was someone in the control room. He drew his pistol, signaled Zavala to do the same, and stepped inside. That's when he saw Lysara. The plant manager looked as if he had fallen asleep, but the bullet hole in his back proclaimed otherwise. His right arm was outstretched, his fingers inches away from the blood-spattered line of switches that would have stopped the generator. A look of barely restrained rage came to Austin's face. He silently vowed that someone would pay for killing the gracious Frenchman whose expertise had enabled Austin to rescue Skye and the other scientists trapped under the glacier. He touched Lysara's neck. The body was cold. Lysara was probably killed shortly after he called Austin. The fact that it would have been impossible to save the Frenchman gave Austin little solace. He went over to the computer monitor that displayed a diagram of the tunnel system and sat down in front of the screen to study the flow of water through the tunnels. Lysara had done a masterful job of diverting the water from the glacial streams away from the observatory tunnel using a complex system of detours. "The tunnels are color-coded," he explained to Zavala. "The blinking blue lines show the tunnels that are wet, and the red lines indicate the dry water conduits." He tapped a red line. "Here's the tunnel we used in the rescue." Zavala leaned over Austin's shoulder and with his finger traced a convoluted route from the observatory access tunnel back to the power plant. "Quite the maze. We'll have to double back a few times and make a couple of jogs." Think of it as a cross between a funhouse and a water park, Austin said. We should come out where our pal Sebastian blew off the sluice gate. From there, it's a short walk to the observatory. Now for the bad news. We've probably got 10 to 15 miles of tunnels to navigate. It could take hours. Longer if we get lost. Not necessarily, Austin said, recalling something Lysara had said about Dr. LeBlanc. He ran off a printout of the computer display and cast a sad glance at Lysara's body, and then he and Zavala left the control room. Moments later, they were on the observation platform where Lysara had shown Austin the power of the glacier's meltwater. The torrent that had reminded Austin of the Colorado River Rapids had become a narrow stream a few yards wide and a foot deep. Satisfied that the tunnel had been drained, he and Zavala went back through the lobby and out the front door of the plant. They walked a couple of hundred yards from the plant's entrance to a sheet metal garage butted up against the mountain wall. The garage housed two vehicles, the utility truck that had picked Austin up on his first visit to the power plant, and, under a plastic cover, Dr. LeBlanc's beloved Citroen 2CV. Austin removed the cloth. Meet Fifi, he said.
Fifi?
It belongs to one of the glacier scientists. He has a thing for her. I've seen prettier women, Zavala said, but I've always said that it's personality that counts. With its humped back and sloping hood, the tough little Citroen 2CV was one of the most distinctive cars ever produced. The auto's designer had said he wanted four wheels under an umbrella, a car that could cross a plowed field without breaking eggs carried in a basket. Fifi had seen some hard miles. Her half-moon rear wheel covers were dented and the faded red paint almost pink and pitted by sand and gravel. Yet she had the jaunty air of a woman who was never beautiful, but infinitely sure of her ability to cope with life. The key was in the ignition. They got in the car and started the engine with no problem. Then he and Zavala drove along a gravel road that followed the base of the mountain wall until they came to a set of high double doors. Austin consulted the map and saw that they were at the site marked as Porte de Sillon. He wasn't sure of the correct translation, but he reasoned that the huge drilling machines that bored out the tunnels must have had a way to get in and out of the mountain. The doors were made of heavy steel, but they were well balanced and opened easily. Austin drove Fifi through the opening into the tunnel, where the whine of her tiny engine echoed off the walls and ceilings. The tunnel went straight into the mountain past the turbine room and entered the main system. They would have been lost in the maze of intersecting tunnels if not for the map. Zavala did yeoman service as a navigator, despite Austin's heavy foot and his quick turns. 15 minutes after they had entered the tunnels, Zavala told Austin to take a left at the next intersection. We're almost at the observatory tunnel, he said. How far? About a half of a mile. I think we'd better leave Fifi and walk from here. Like the rest of the system, the tunnel had a string of lights running along the ceiling. Many of the bulbs had burned out and not been replaced. The sporadic lighting intensified the blackness of the unlit sections between the pale circles of light. As the two men trudged along, the dripping orange walls gave off a damp, raw cold that numbed their faces, and the chill tried to sneak in around the collars of the down jackets they had found in the crew quarters. They told me that when I joined NUMA, I would go places, Zavala said. But I didn't know I'd have to walk there. Think of it as a character-building experience, Austin said cheerfully. After a few more minutes of character building, they came to a ladder that ran up the side of a wall to a catwalk. A section of the walkway was enclosed by plastic and glass. Austin remembered Lysara mentioning satellite control rooms scattered throughout the tunnel system. They kept on walking and had just turned into a new tunnel when Austin's keen ear picked up a sound that was loud enough to drown out the ongoing chorus of gurgles and drips. What's that? He said, cupping his hand to his ear. Zavala listened for a moment. Sounds like a locomotive. Austin shook his head. That's no ghost train. Run! Zavala was transfixed. He stood in place, as rigid as a statue, until Austin's voice pulled him out of his trance. Then he took off like a sprinter at the starting gun, keeping a step behind Austin. They splashed through puddles, ignoring the spray that soaked their clothes from the waist down. The rushing grew louder and became a roar. Austin made a quick right-angle turn into another tunnel. Zavala tried to follow but skidded on the wet floor. Austin saw Zavala fall. He went back and pulled his friend up by the wrist, and they were off again, running from the unseen menace. The floor seemed to vibrate under their pounding feet as the noise reached a mind-numbing level. Austin's frantic eyes saw the metal ladder that ran up the wall to the catwalk. He grabbed onto the first rung and pulled himself up like a circus acrobat. Zavala had hurt his knee in his fall and was having trouble climbing with his usual agility. Austin reached down and pulled his partner onto the catwalk, and they dove into the control booth. Just in time. A second after they had slammed the watertight door shut, a huge blue wave cascaded through the tunnel. The catwalk disappeared under the rushing, foaming water that battered the windows like seas slamming into a ship in a storm. The catwalk shook from the impact, and for a moment Austin feared that the whole structure, control booth and all, would be washed away. After the first shock, the torrent moderated, but the height of the river still reached the bottom of the catwalk. Austin went over to the control panel and stared at the diagram. He was worried that a sluice gate had given way, allowing the full force of the glacial meltwater to pour through the tunnel. If that were the case, they would be stuck in the control room until they died or the glacier melted entirely. The tunnel line was still red, indicating that it was dry. He saw this as a ray of hope because it meant that the flow of water came from a pocket of water and might have a beginning and an end. It turned out to be a very large pocket. 5 minutes that seemed like 5 years went by before the flow of water began to abate. Once the water level started to drop, it did so with great rapidity until they were able to go out onto the catwalk without danger of being washed off. Zavala watched the still formidable torrent and yelled over the sound, "I thought you said this would be like a fun house." "Some fun? Some house?" "I think I said something about a water park, too." It took another 10 minutes for the water flow to diminish to a point where it was safe to descend the ladder. Austin considered the possibility of other pockets bursting open, but put the thought out of his mind and led the way through the maze of tunnels. On one occasion, a tunnel that was supposed to be dry proved to be otherwise. They would have become dangerously wet instead of uncomfortably damp if they had tried to ford the stream and chose to detour around it. According to the map, they were within minutes of the access tunnel to the glacial observatory. Eventually, they came to a massive steel door which was similar to the sluice gates they had seen in other tunnels. This one was different from the others they had encountered. The thick steel was peeled back like the skin of an orange. Zavala went over and gingerly touched the twisted steel. "This must be the door that Fauchard's goon blew off its hinges." Austin borrowed the map and pointed to a tunnel line. "We're here," he said. "We go through the door and take a right, and the observatory is about a half a mile walk. We'd better stay alert and keep the noise down." "I'll do my best to keep my teeth from chattering, but it won't be easy." Their light-hearted bantering was deceptive. Both men were well aware of the potential danger they faced, and their concern was evident in the care they used to check their firearms. As they entered the main tunnel, Austin gave Zavala a whispered description of the lab setup. He told him about the lab buildings, then the staircase leading to the observatory tunnel, and the ice chamber where Jules Fauchard was entombed. They were nearing the lab trailers when Zavala started limping again. His injured knee was giving him trouble. He told Austin to go ahead and he'd catch up in a minute. Austin thought about checking out the trailers, but the windows were dark and he assumed that Emil and his men were in the observatory itself. He learned that he was wrong when a door swung quietly open behind him, and a man's voice told him in French to get his hands in the air. Then he was ordered to turn around slowly. In the murky light, Austin could make out a hulking figure. Although the tunnel was dim, stray shafts of light reflected off the gun pointed in his direction. "Hello," Sebastian said in a pleasant voice. "Master Emil has been waiting for you."